Summer is Winter. Reading from The Unknown Reality, Volume 1, a Seth book by Jane Roberts. Notes by Rob. This is the second and last verse of a poem Jane wrote in April 1952 when she was 23 years old. Even in this immature work, which she produced 11 years before she was to initiate the Seth material, her mystical nature was asserting its innate knowledge. Jane. Summer is winter. Today is tomorrow, and present, past. Nothing exists, and everything will last. There is no beginning, there was no end, no depth to fall, no height to ascend. There is only this moment, this flicker of light, that illuminates nothing but, oh, so bright. For we are the spark that flutters in space, consuming an eternity of a moment's grace. For today is tomorrow and present past. Nothing exists and everything will last. Session 679, February 4, 1974. Reading from The Unknown Reality, Volume 1, a Seth book by Jane Roberts. The first session in Volume 1, Session 679, February 4, 1974. Notes by Rob. Before the session, I showed Jane a childhood photograph of herself and one of me. The two pictures are roughly the same size, about 3 1/4 by 5 inches. They also look remarkably alike in their brittle and discolored condition, almost as if though they'd been snapped at the same time, yet mine is older than Jane's by 20 years. The photograph of me, taken and dated by her father, Robert Sr., has been kept in one of the Butts family albums for 53 years. In it, the time is June 1, 1921. I am almost 2 years old. I have curly, light-colored hair. I wear a one-piece suit, long white stockings, and black shoes. I stand in the side yard of the house my parents rented in Mansfield, a small college town in northeastern Pennsylvania. Perhaps a dozen chicks cluster in the grass at my feet while I stare down at them, quite entranced. In blurred focus behind me, an unknown teenage girl sits on a swing that's suspended from a tree limb, and an empty wicker stroller-like carriage, mine, stands beside her. Parked in a driveway in back of her is a four-door touring car with a fabric top. I might add that Mansfield is only 35 miles below Elmira, New York, where Jane and I live now. The photograph of Jane is 33 years old. It was taken by an older lady friend who was treating her to an outing at a spa just outside of the New York State Resort of Saratoga Springs, where Jane lived with her bedridden mother, Marie, and a housekeeper. In a childish hand, Jane had scrawled her friend's name on the back of the picture, along with the date. Many years later, she was to tell me, my mother hated that woman. In the snapshot, it's a sunlit day in August 1941. Jane is 12 years old. She sits on the grass before some evergreen shrubs. She leans slightly back on her right hand, her bare legs rather primly folded. She wears a printed dress that had been given her in the Roman Catholic orphanage in Troy, some 35 miles from Saratoga Springs. She'd spent the previous 18 months there in the institution while her mother had been hospitalized in another city for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Jane also wears a short-sleeved pullover sweater. Her mother had knitted it during her stay in the hospital. Jane's blonde hair, which was to turn quite black, is neatly parted and combed, and she wears a barrette in it. Her face is youthfully round, but quite unsmiling. She's not scowling. Rather, from her position on the grass, she just stares directly out of the photograph at the viewer, displaying a somber, almost controlled regard that seems out of place for one of that age. To me, both photographs had a certain mysterious quality that I'd often found intriguing, an aura due partly to their being old, personal, and so irreplaceable, I suppose. But for a long time, I'd been aware of other feelings connected with them. Jane had begun delivering the Seth material late in 1963. And soon afterwards, Seth started developing his ideas on probabilities. Interjecting footnote 1 for session 679 here now. Seth tells us that all actions are initially mental in nature. Very simple probable realities flow from the multidimensionous actions or events we may envision, but choose not to actualize physically. But any motion of ours remains quite valid once it is conceived, and is carried out in all of its variations by probable selves in other realities. There can be communication between at least some of these worlds. Jane has had a modest success in touching upon a few of her probable selves, and plans to write about those experiments and others she hopes to conduct. Seth, in his material on probable systems, in chapter 16 of Seth Speaks, says, "The soul can be described, for that matter, as a multidimensional, infinite act, each minute probability being brought somewhat into actuality and existence, an infinite creative act that creates for itself infinite dimensions in which fulfillment is possible." Then see chapter 15 of the Seth material, Probable Selves and Probable Systems of Reality, end footnote 1. And now continuing Rob's comments at the beginning of session 679. Many times while looking at the snapshots since then, I'd found myself speculating about the probable realities surrounding their two young subjects. I told Jane now that I understood the course of action each of us had taken to make physical or real in our terms. But what of all the other paths our probable selves had embarked upon since those pictures had been taken? By now, did those photographs actually depict the immature images of us, the Jane and Rob we knew and had always been? Or from our standpoint, did they show a probable Jane, a probable Rob, two individuals who long ago set out upon their own journeys through other realities? I wasn't clear on what I wanted to know, and had trouble expressing myself to Jane. Maybe I just wanted Seth to comment on probabilities in a more personal way. And added later, at the time I had no idea that my questioning would trigger a new Seth book. The outward signs of Jane's trance performances as Seth are very interesting in themselves, and I don't intend to minimize them. Indeed, I describe them every so often. My real fascination, however, lies with what I call the greatly enhanced consciousness or energy that she displays in the sessions. And always I sense an even more powerful flow of that quality just beneath the surface of her delivery. I thought of this as Jane sat quietly in her Kennedy rocker, waiting for Seth to come through. After a few minutes, her right hand lifted to her glasses. As she took them off, her eyes were much darker and more luminous than they usually are. She was dissociated in trance. Seth was there, staring at me. Seth. Now, good evening. Rob. Good evening, Seth. As Seth, Jane briefly handed the two photographs I'd placed on the coffee table between us. Seth. I am doing two things here, but you can also have the material on any picture separately if you choose to. Rob. Yes? Seth. Each of you, again, chose your parents and environment. You spoke in your notes 2 days ago of precognition in connection with art. An excellent point. Precognition in those terms also applies at your birth, when ahead of time you are quite aware on unconscious levels of those conditions that you will meet. You have chosen them and projected them ahead of you out into the medium of time. The conditions, however, while set in one fashion, are highly plastic in another, so that a multitudinous variety of probable events can flow from them. Precognitively, you are unconsciously quite aware, again in your terms, of the results of any given action or cause. When this photograph of Rupert was taken, at this point, footnote 3 is inserted into the text and reading. Almost always, Seth refers to Jane by her male entity name, Rupert, and so he, his, and him. To sum up Seth's somewhat amused comments in the 12th session for January 2, 1964, sex, regardless of all your fleshy tells, is a psychic phenomenon, merely certain qualities which you call male and female. The qualities are real, however, and permeate other planes as well as your own. They are opposites, which are nevertheless complementary, and which merge into one. When I say, as I have, that the overall entity or whole self is neither male or female, and yet refer to some entities by definitely male names such as Rupert and Joseph, as Seth calls me, I merely mean that in the overall essence, the given entity identifies itself more with the so-called male characteristics than with the female. End of note 3, returning to the text. Seth, continuing, this was against her mother's judgment. She felt that public schools were better and more socially beneficial. Rupert, at that age, when he changed at the third grade, had quite a will then, in that he forced his mother to acquiesce to the change of schools. He put up such a fuss, Rupert, and held such temper tantrums that permission was given. He was stubborn even then. He was always highly imaginative, as was his mother. His mother was socially defiant, flaunting her beauty with the disreputable elements of society. Much later, Rupert would date the disreputable men in his environment, yet neither mother or daughter saw the parallel. Rupert's mother by then wanted a respectable, hopefully rich husband for Rupert, and could not understand why he chose men who did not conform. Rupert chose a background in which he was poor, as did the mother. The mother was also bright, but chose to bank upon beauty for escape from her environment. Rupert tried his brains instead. That material has been given over the years in a series of personal sessions, notes Rob. Rupert's nonconformance took the larger framework of unconventional ideas. In the background, as a child under the organization of the welfare department, self-indulgent small luxuries or too unconventional behavior were all dangerous in the framework chosen. The neighbors could report any transgressions to welfare. At about this time, tapping the photo, Rupert sat on the lap of an adult man on the front porch, and neighbors duly reported this, the idea being that sexual depravity could be involved. Rupert's mother knew that the child could be taken away were it proven that she was an unfit mother in any way or unable to give the child proper care. Well, over a year before this picture was taken, in fact, Rupert was sent to a Catholic home. There, unconventional thought was not tolerated. The inflexibility of dogma conscientiously applied to daily action was experienced, and within it, Rupert tried to apply himself and to focus his deeply mystical nature. He remembered his mother's constant criticism of him, but barely recalls his scandalized disapproval of her swearing, for example, on his return home. He threw himself headlong into the Catholic reality, pursued it with great stubborn diligence, used it as a framework of conventionality in which he could allow his mystic nature to grow. When that nature grew out of the framework, he left it. All the beliefs that had once seemed so legitimate were then seen as hampering, and all their defects became plain. While he followed the framework, nothing could swerve him from it. And here, touching the photograph in this child's picture, you already have the swerving nature, the great spontaneity, looking for a structure that will allow it growth and yet give the illusion of safety. The placid-looking child in the photo was as dogmatic and unyielding in some respects as Rupert has ever been. Yet leaving the church framework, Rupert fastened upon the mind as opposed to the intuitions. The child here was convinced that statutes of Christ moved. Without a framework to contain that kind of experience, the growing girl began to squash it. Mystical experience became acceptable only through poetry or art, where it was accepted as creative, but not real enough to get him into trouble or to upset the new framework. The new framework threw aside such superstitious nonsense. The mind would be harnessed, and art became the acceptable translator of mystical experience, and a cushion between that experience and the self. He threw some of the baby out with the bathwater. The mystical went underground, reappearing as science fiction. Rob notes, insert footnote 6 here, which reads, "It took more than a little while for Jane's mystical nature to show itself in prose. 2 years after we married, she published her first work of fiction, a short story about reincarnation called The Red Wagon. It appeared in the December 1956 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, 1956 by Fantasy House Incorporated, New York, New York. She was 27 years old and most pleased with the beginning of her professional career. Within the next several years, she sold a number of additional stories to the same magazine, as well as two short novels, and also published poetry and a little fiction in other markets. Jane regarded all of these works as being science, fantasy, rather than straight science fiction. Her fictional themes, especially, were extensions of much of her earlier poetry and contained the same kind of thinking that had led her breaking with her church. She had no conscious intimations that within a decade she would develop the Seth material. My mind just worked that way, Jane said of her stories. I was concerned with those themes, so I wrote about them. I remember being a little surprised at her subject matter for The Red Wagon, for it's not contradictory to write here that even though she was so interested in reincarnation as a theory, she seldom talked about it. The Red Wagon is included in the collection Ladies of Fantasy, Two Centuries of Sinister Stories by the Gentle Sex, 1975 by Manley and Lewis, and published by Gothrop, Lee and Shepherd Company, New York, New York. And now continuing, session 679, Seth, again in the social and religious background of the child, unconventional mental or physical actions could bring penalties. For a while, the child could interpret mystical experience within the church, but even then, there was always conflict with church authorities. Without this experience of following such a belief in the church so fervently, however, he would not understand the need of people for such beliefs, or be able to reach them as well as he does. His questioning mind was exercised originally as he began to examine religious beliefs. He was afraid that psychic experience, when he encountered it much later, might lead to a new dogma, and was determined not to use it in such a way. His conservatism, meaning his strong recognition of conservative ideas, is used as a springboard. He leaps from where he knows other people are into new areas. He combats the dogma of spiritualism as much as he did the dogma of the church. He leaped, however, from the framework of the church into another framework, one in which mysticism was experienced secondhand, under the guise of artistic production. Idea construction literally shattered that framework. For various reasons already given concerning your joint relationship and your own purposes, it was given some time for a newer, suitable framework to form itself, one in which Rupert is free to pursue mystic experience in a practical structure, one in which unconventionality of thought is allowed to continue freely. He felt that this could outgrow the framework of his art, as it did that of the church. The physical symptoms served quite literally as a framework in which spontaneity was, to some extent at least, allowed a mental and psychic freedom until he felt secure. In regards to the physical symptoms in the above, Rob inserts footnote 8, which reads, "As Seth, Jane delivered several excellent pages of material on her physical symptoms in the 645th session for March 5, 1973, in Chapter 11 of Personal Reality. It's taken us some years to understand that behind Jane's symptoms lay her efforts to understand and express the very strong creative energy she's sensed within herself since childhood. Yet the conflict that developed between her writing self and her mystical self, as explained by Seth in Personal Reality, was only one facet of her intuitive drive toward that expression. As Jane matured, she realized that there were other challenges for her to contend with, too. Among them were the resolution of some old family relationships. And nowhere in this note am I talking about past lives or probable lives, but just the working out of hard questions rooted in this present physical reality. From Seth and ourselves, we've accumulated much unpublished material about Jane's symptoms and attendant matters. The bulk of it is often applicable to others, and eventually we may write a book about the whole subject. Should she do so, it would certainly be a history of one person's long efforts to grapple as fully as possible, and not always successfully, with her own human qualities. But I also think that in many ways it would be her most illuminating work. She fully accepts the idea that she creates her own reality. In the meantime, Jane's making good progress in handling her personal challenges. Even her work consists mainly of dissolving the set of protective symbolic body beliefs that she placed about the use of her great energy." Now returning again to read in session 679, Seth. "Now, you are correct. Probabilities are, of course, involved. Remember the first few sentences of this session. The general overall conditions were chosen, but many probable courses were concerned." Rob notes, "As Seth, Jane pointed to the photograph of herself taken when she was 12 years old. Seth, that child took a different course than this woman did," Jane indicated herself as she sat in her rocker. Seth continues, "The dogmatism prevailed. The child's mystical nature, while strong, was not strong enough to defy the church framework. To leave it or to rise above it provided symbolism. It, the mysticism, was to be expressed, if curtailed, relatively speaking. The mind would be harnessed so that it would not ask too many questions. That child," in the photo notes Rob, "joined a nunnery, where she learned to regulate mystical experience according to acceptable precepts, but to express it nevertheless with some regularity, continuously, in a way of life that at least recognized its existence. In your terms, the intersection with probabilities occurred one day in an interview the child had with a priest. The event, in Rupert's terms, with its results in your probability, is mentioned in his rich bed." See note 4. Now switching to note 4, reads, "Jane is treating the many, often chaotic details of her life in her autobiography, From This Rich Bed, She's been working on the project for some time, along with her other books, and it may develop into more than one volume. In a very simplified summary from Rich Bed, Jane was the only child of Marie Bardot and Delmer Roberts. She was 2 years old when her parents were divorced in 1931. With her daughter, the young Marie then returned to her own parents and the home that the family had rented for a number of years, half of a double dwelling in a poor neighborhood in Saratoga Springs, New York. Marie began experiencing the early stages of rheumatoid arthritis, but worked as much as possible. Eventually, Jane's grandfather, Joseph Bardot, with whom she shared a deep mystical identification, was unable to support two extra people, and the family had to rely upon public assistance. Jane's grandmother was killed in an automobile accident in 1936. The next year, her grandfather moved out of the house. By then, Marie was partially incapacitated, and the welfare department began to furnish mother and daughter with occasional, and often unreliable, domestic help. Thus, Jane was 9 years old in 1938 when she changed schools after finishing the third grade. Always, when Jane and I present personal material in Unknown Reality, we have several things in mind. We not only want to give necessary background information relative to the sessions themselves, but to offer glimpses into the very complicated emotional and physical forces that lie beneath close long-term relationships. We think Seth's comments about our situations can help the reader better understand his or her own beliefs, motives, and desires. And now returning to Seth in session 679, the child in 7th or 8th grade wrote a poem expressing the desire to be a nun and brought it to a parish priest. In your probability, the priest told the child that she was needed by her mother, but intuitively he saw that Rupert's mysticism would not fit into the church organization. In the other probability, Rupert's desire at that time won. He managed to water down the extent and dimensions of his mysticism enough so that it was acceptable. In that other probability, there will be no long period of time in which the mystical experience would lie latent, and no necessity at all to put it into new terms. The writing ability would follow as its handmaiden. In this world, the artistic abilities were put first, but the mystical nature was given greater chances to expand and develop. And both are given the opportunity and the challenge of shattering old historic frameworks and of rising beyond them. Rupert here chose the writing structure and has stuck to it as unswervingly as he once stuck to the church, yet always seeking a new framework. For a while he idealized you. Your guidance and strength were his framework. When it became apparent that you were also human and not a framework, he became frightened. When you encouraged the emergence and expression of his mysticism, then you could no longer act, he felt, as a framework to contain it. By then, it seemed to threaten the joint structure of your lives. He knew intuitively that you also used artistic creation as a buffer between yourself and mystical expression. For all of the reasons given, and they are clearly given in personal sessions, he was afraid that spontaneity, mental or physical, would threaten the long-accepted framework of your joint lives. If he went spontaneously forward in mystical experience, then given his ideas, it threatened the conventional acceptance of his art. Conventional ideas of art and writing, upon which the old framework now was dependent, no longer fit. Once again, his natural experience, he felt, was leading him beyond structures he had considered safe. He had you to consider. This experience of his was taking time from your art as well as his own to his way of thinking. At the same time, the mystical nature rejoiced at its opportunity and sensed its potential. Rupert was determined to go ahead. He was also determined to keep the old structures and to ignore the cracks in them. In part, his loyalty to you was connected, and his responsibility, as he saw it, to keep you focused as an artist and to let nothing distract you. Yet here he was distracting you. For a while, your joint communications system was shaky. He was afraid to go ahead. The symptoms kept him at his job, at home, and allowed him to concentrate without outside distractions, kept him writing, with mystical experience dutifully translated into art. The symptoms also served to focus that fantastic energy while he figured out how it should be used. He could not accept a new psychic framework while within it there were questions concerning your joint ideas of business and divided loyalties about writing and painting, your personal fears jointly about spontaneity in general, and the need to protect your talents from both your own sexual natures and the distractions of others. He could not accept the new framework, and he dared not let the old one go. So the symptoms became the physical materialization of these conflicts and served many purposes. This child in the photo, grown up in its own probability, has no such problems. The challenges are not there either, only in latent form. Give us a moment. Rupert greatly needs to realize that you love him and accept him as he is now in your terms. He gets from you what feeling of creaturehood acceptance he has that you received in your own way from your family in early years. Your questioning, Joseph, and your deep distrust of the world's current theories are shared as intensely by Rupert, and your joint insistence upon discovering new answers is responsible for these sessions and what will come from them. You see his joyful potential, and he knows that you do. Sometimes he feels lost, however, as an emotional human being groping toward that potential, and he needs to be comforted. As you know now, confronting him can be frightening to you because it returns you both to deep emotional realizations and feelings that you sublimate in your paintings and even to mystical experiences that you also channel through your work. Take a break. Seth, now, let us briefly for now attend to this. Rodnos. Seth Jane held up the photograph of me taken when I was about 2 years old. Footnote 9. Seth has discussed the members of the Butts family at times, including some of their reincarnational aspects. 6 months before beginning Unknown Reality, however, he made a few remarks that I've applied ever since to life in our physical reality. Quote, each person chooses his or her parents, accepting in terms of environment and heredity, a bank of characteristics, attitudes, and abilities from which to draw into physical life. There is always a reason, and so each parent will present to each child an unspeakable symbol. And often the two parents will represent glaring contrasts and different probabilities so that the child can compare and contrast divergent realities. Your two brothers also chose the family situation. Each parent, both of whom are now deceased, represented opposites to them, but individual ones, and so they saw your parents differently, as you did. Do not lose contact with them. From this, it also follows that my mother and father saw their individual creations or versions of each of their children. End footnote 9. Seth. That child enjoys great feelings of vigor and safety. In your family relationship so far, so good. You were mainly surrounded by love and affirmation. Your parents were young. Your mother had produced 2 beautiful boys, and she was also a perfectionist in her way and her framework, one never understood by your father. It was on the surface a very conventional structure, yet underneath highly unwieldy. There were dogmas. The mother was expected to bear perfect children and to be subservient to the male, at least in outward fashion. Your mother felt then that each played a fitting part in the marriage, in that your father had in her eyes great prospects, and she had given him 2 sons. It was only later that she felt he had not fulfilled his part of the bargain, and that you began to feel insecure. She had forced herself to focus all of her great emotional power into the marriage structure, as they both understood it. But your father would not concentrate his own abilities into the cultural and financial structure, as he had agreed to do in the tacit contract. She had forced herself to contain her own reality in conventional terms, but to her way of thinking, he refused to use his energy in the accepted social and financial structure that each of them had accepted. You began to feel, years later, as Rupert did, that creativity was in its way dangerous, that it would lead you outside of accepted social structures and definitely must be protected against normal family life. Rob notes, picking up the photo of me, Seth, not in this picture, but quite alive, was your brother Lyndon. You insisted upon using your abilities and tried for years to fit them into the commercial pattern, where they were accepted financially and socially, and in terms of your self-image. Finally, you grew outside of the structure. When you did, you made the artificial decision in which good art would not sell, but you would do it anyway. Footnote 10 here. I gave up my commitment to commercial art in 1953 when I was 34 years old. My intuitive desire to do so had been growing slowly for several years. The act of separation finally became conscious and deliberate when I moved to a small community near Saratoga Springs, New York, where Jane lived, to temporarily help an artist-writer friend produce a syndicated comic strip. This was the last commercial work I was to do for some time. I finally understood that I was simply more interested in painting pictures than in doing anything else. Since I believe that each of us creates our own reality in the most precise terms, it can hardly be a coincidence that at this time of decision, my friend introduced Jane and me, for she was just as devoted to writing as I was to painting. And returning to the text of section 679, Seth continues, when you did, you made the artificial division in which good art would not sell, but you would do it anyway. You would make your creativity real in sense terms. Lyndon would not. He would keep it safely inside a play structure, not play necessarily in basic terms, but a structure in which he would work with models cleverly, never applying his creative abilities in certain ways to a practical reality. They would be outside safely in that context. The abilities that he possessed that could be channeled into society as he understood it were so handled. In such an eventuality, fragmentation occurred so that the abilities were dispersed, some directed into school, some into drawing, and others into his models. Those creative attributes were separated so that they could be safely handled, yet expressed to some degree, and not completely denied. Your own character is in its way more direct, meaning that you maintained a more immediate focus. When that picture was taken, however, your parents were beginning to realize their difficulty. Your first year was one in which your father and mother were filled with expectation. Lyndon sensed that lack. He was secure, but not as secure as you had been, as the division between your parents was beginning to show. Lyndon used words now as a framework to contain creativity and communication rather than to express them. You were more free-roaming then, in the photo, as a child, because you felt safer physically. Lyndon was far less venturesome in that respect. Rob notes, after a pause, Seth delivered a page of material for Jane before ending the session at 12:16. As I interpret this information on the photographs then, Jane's depicts an individual who was to become a probable Jane to the one I know, while mine is pretty much an early version of the self who's always lived in this reality.